Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
Emails.
I got an email right here and I'm going to read it. I love this email so much. It is from a Dutch woman. A tall Dutch woman.
That fits in to the topic we discussed last week about shorter men.
Yes. And some of the emotions that they have to deal with if they are not satisfied with their height or if they want to be taller. Hey, love your program. Laughed my way through most of your talk about dating and men's height. I am a 6 foot tall woman. Yeah, I'm Dutch. And was happily married for 25 years to my now late husband, who was 5'11 when we started dating, and likely 5'10 before he passed away 10 years ago. After a period of deep grief, I re-entered the dating world at the age of 56 and found no men would show interest whatsoever. That was all caps there. No men would show interest whatsoever if I posted my actual height in dating apps. So I set it to be 5'11 and the roller coaster ride of senior dating began. I won't bore you with a litany of horrible date details, but more men lied than my 1-inch little lie, i.e. they said that they were taller than they actually were. The absolute reversal of what this woman did, namely lie about her height so that she was shorter, they said that they were taller.
That's interesting.
It goes, what were you saying? That people would, on these dating apps, scroll unless the person was above a certain height?
There was
6 foot, right?
There was a study that Gabe, you took this email kind of to read to me. I hadn't read it in its entirety, but what I immediately thought of was a study I couldn't find. I went looking for it now, and I couldn't find it. And what I believe the study implied was that, or it confirmed what she was saying, that taller women, very tall women, are approached less frequently. And I can't remember if it was in real life. I don't know how you would study that.
I mean, I'm wondering whether the same thing goes for tall women that was studied in the work that we talked about last week, that there's more competition, more jealousy and envy among taller women because it's harder then?
I think
it is harder.
Yeah. Now that you're saying that, the biggest takeaway from last week that I think now drifts over into this is that if you're not satisfied with your height, probably one direction or the other, that these feelings of insecurity or of jealousy, of competition with people who are the height that you wish you were, are going to increase. And that's not a good thing. And that hopefully somehow, some way, you can find a way to come to terms with it. That's way easier said than done. But just accept, this is what I am. And a lot of people find this very attractive.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what height you are. I'm going to hop into a different email.
But thank you so much, Haiti, for that email.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, Gabe and Connor, I'm a math professor living in San Diego County. That's in the southern part of California, who regularly listens to your show because I like the way you make science accessible. In the latest one, you invited listeners to meet up with you, not for the first time, and you offered some free swag. I think your show's great and would love to meet up sometime for a coffee or a meal. That's where I was thinking, okay, if I'm in San Diego at some point.
Yeah,
why not? San Diego's great. It just so happens that my daughter studies at the University of Bonn, and I'm planning to visit her there in late June. I've been there a couple times. I go by the area that we're sitting in now. And let me know if you have some availability to meet. And he gives a date in late June. I think the answer is yes, right?
Yeah.
You and I have not discussed this.
He mentioned a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday. Does memory serve there?
Yeah.
Let's do the Friday?
Yeah. Andre.
If you're listening to this right now, Andre, let's come here on Friday, June.
Yeah. January June is a lot like June. Yeah.
June 26th. And we will absolutely have a coffee or hang out.
I think, is the 26th a Friday? I think the 26th is a Thursday. Or am I wrong?
Okay, well then come here on Thursday the 26th.
Wait a minute, yeah, okay.
At 5 p.m. or 6 p.m., Andre, and we'll hang out.
There we go. It's a date. We'll email you too. We'll do more than just broadcast this over the radio waves. Gabe, one last email.
I've got one here. I think it's about the swag, as you were mentioning there. Hi, guys. It's Greg. Love your show. I am not near Bonn, but want to get an SU hat. Is it a ball hat? or toque? 2K? What does that even mean?
I don't know.
T-O-U-Q-U-E? I don't know what that... I've never seen that word before in my life. I can mail a pre-addressed box or envelope. What is your mailing address? How many euros will I send for postage? Cheers, Greg. Don't worry about it, Greg. These hats, you really don't want one.
That's your reaction to that? I was just going to say, we need your address. We'll email you to get that address, and then we'll pass it along. We've got a deep, deep in the underground of DW. Yeah. This is a labyrinthian building. It really is. There is the Poststelle, the place where you can get things sent. We will get that to you. Keep in mind that the last time we promised this, we did deliver, but it was probably 7 months later.
I just want to say a word of warning. We were being kind of sarcastic when we were talking about the hats, weren't we?
No, we made it clear. They're cheap.
Okay.
We got way too many of them. They're cheap. The print comes off. It says SU in the print. The black S or U starts to come off after a little bit of wear. But yeah, they're there. They exist, and you can definitely have one.
All right, Greg.
On to the science. Political polarization. There have been a lot of studies, particularly over the last decade, about how in a lot of prominent democracies around the world, how people are more inclined to be strongly for one of the often two major parties in their country than ever before. You can track that over time. How many surveys on this have been done? Wait, tons. You can see this. And we all are somewhat aware, probably, that this has negative outcomes when it comes to, or potential negative outcomes when it comes to governance, right? Everything is polarized. Parties that used to agree with each other in the past don't really agree with each other now as much. They're more vociferously opposed to each other. We're not going to get into that. A new study has looked at what happens at the most personal level as a result of that, meaning with your relationships, your romantic relationships. What happens when both you and your partner are becoming more polarized too? This is research partially from the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research here in Germany and also from Padua, Italy. And it was looking at UK data from the last 30 years. That's what makes it good. It started back in 1991. The data collection goes all the way up to 2019 and includes 30,000 people who were involved in these. I think it's in an annual face-to-face population representative survey. This is good quality data. And what they're looking at there is how often do these people divorce as a result of political differences? Because if we can establish that, and then also, we also know that political polarization is happening. That's problematic. It means more people are going to divorce. If you and your partner have different political affiliations, the term here is heterogamous. You both like different parties as opposed to homogamous, like in the same party. Mm. Then there is up to a 38% higher risk of divorce.
It is 38% more likely if you are heterogamous,
yeah,
that you're going to break up because of that difference, or is that
can't say that. This is association and correlation, and now you're getting into one of the limitations of the study,
okay,
which was selection bias. What if the people who end up in those relationships, you have different political orientations already, perhaps, mm-hmm, are a different group of people, a different demographic, because maybe their romantic opportunities aren't as open, and so they end up with a partner who's much more different from them than they would even want. That is one of the limitations. The other thing they looked at was this is again very particular to the UK. They were looking at Brexit and whether you and your partner agreed on what happened there. If both partners said that they would have preferred the UK to remain in the EU, then there was roughly a 0.9% that they would divorce in a given year. If, however, they were different and one said, no, it was good that we left, it was good that we exited the EU, and the other said, no, I would have preferred to remain, they had a 1.8%, a much, much higher, in this case, twice as high likelihood that they would separate. Final limitation in the study is they didn't look at the strength of party affiliation, and that may be relevant, how strongly in one direction or the other. Do you attach your ideas or your political philosophies to one party, and that's something they'd like to look up or look into in the future?
Religion. And this is a very, this has to be said from the start, this is a very specific set of people born in the late 80s. And they were asking a very specific set of questions. So, do you go to church? Are you affiliated with, in organized, with a major organized religion? Do you believe in God? Do you try and convert people? And do you meditate? The first one, do you go to church, went down over that period of time from 03 to 13, from 80% to 60%.
80% of the respondents at that time, in that age bracket, were going to church?
Teenagers. When those American teenagers were asked, that has to be, I forgot that, this is U.S. data. When those American teenagers were asked in 2003, do you go to church? Over 80% went. And when they were asked in 2013, do you go? Less than 60%.
So they'd moved away, though.
They'd gone to college and have moved away from their families and entered the working world.
Yeah.
But still, from 80% down to
60%. Well, you're talking about me here. I'm part of the 20% that
dropped
out.
I was going to get to that later. Yeah. There's more data to look at. So this was and again, they were four different times over that span of 10 years. So you could look at longitudinally what happens over time. People go from church to not going to church. Affiliation with a major religion went from 89% to 60%. Belief in God, a little bit less, from 83 to 66, but still significant. Do you try and convert? Fewer people are going to do this, but it definitely dropped 10%. And do you meditate? That was the only one that went up. It went up from 12% to 21%. So almost a 10% increase. While everything else fell, meditation goes up. And that's why these researchers, so that there was the longitudinal survey on the one hand, but also on the other hand, they had in-depth interviews with 54 of those 1,300 candidates to look at why. And obviously, we can't get into the details of all those in-depth interviews, but the broad pattern of them, the researchers said that people were at odds with the judgmental, hypocritical, and out-of-touch aspects of the church or major organized religion, and more in favor of personal authenticity, moral autonomy, and flexible spiritual expression. So two things there, flexible and spiritual.
Yeah, and real quick, the meditation doesn't surprise me because I would say that may not be spiritual at all. I think there's a tendency to connect it to spirituality, but I know, and for all the people who practice meditation out there, please send an email or correct me or add something to this discussion because I myself don't. But a lot of times that has no connection to any religion at all. Meditation or mindfulness, these are practices that a lot of people engage in to calm themselves, to ready themselves, prepare themselves for the day. And I guess all I'm trying to say is that increase does not surprise me. In fact, I don't even connect it necessarily with a religion.
Yeah, yeah. These were people born in the late 80s, so we're talking about a specific group. And if you want to read up on the study, it's Breaking Free of the Iron Cage, the Individualization of American Religion. And that iron cage is a reference to the German sociologist Max Weber, who spoke about that iron cage, the father of sociology. I just had to mention that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know. And one last thing I'll mention here, because I forgot to say it. When I was talking about that research earlier, polarization and everything politicized and how that affects relationships. The message for everyone out there, and I include myself here, is to pay attention to when you get really riled up by something that you read, usually on your phone, in a political manner, something that gets you all fired up with one of those hot point, those talking points, one of those hot takes, and you're just. And the reason I say that is, of course, I'm going to give an anecdote that makes me sound favorable. But it happened recently with my own wife where we'd had a nice breakfast. We both looked at our phones while we're drinking a cup of coffee. And all of a sudden, she kind of ripped into me on, I forget what it was about. And I don't know why. I was really happy with myself later. I sensed it. I was like, hold on. What did you just read on your phone? What was the last thing you read? And it was just that, a very polarizing opinion piece on some German news website. And she laughed because she's, oh, shoot, that is, yeah, I think that is where that emotion came from. Be aware of how, or try to be aware of how what you're consuming in video form, in audio form here, or in text,
yeah,
is that causing an emotional change, a polarizing political change, and how that may ultimately disrupt your relationship? Because it doesn't have to.
Of course, and imagine if you guys are members of different political parties and she's just read something about how horrible the people
are
from that other party that you my husband belongs to, and then she just rips into you.
Maybe the best advice is to, what we should have done is just not picked up our phones at breakfast. Leave them down. Just drink the coffee, look at each other, and talk.
Yeah.
Anything else to say? Any suggestions, comments? Anyone else looking for some free hats with peeling letters on them? SU@DW.com.
The hats say that on them. SU.
Are you an unhappy, exhausted parent? I'm fully aware that not all of you listening are that, but maybe you have been in the past or know somebody who seems like they're in that situation right now. Unhappy or less happy than they could be.
Less satisfied?
Less satisfied person. Because you
because of
are,
the hardships of parenting?
Yeah. And you might tend to think, well, that's just how it is, right? Well, no. And that's according to new research by Marita Jakob. And it's the interesting part is not that you're slightly less happy. It's that is probably dependent on where you live. And you can do some things about it.
Science Unscripted.
So, hello, my name is Marita Jakob. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Cologne. And recently, a colleague of mine and I did a study on parenthood and parents' well-being.
What would you say, Marita, is the chief finding or the conclusion when you're trying to look at the well-being of parents out there?
One of the main conclusions is that there are two different aspects. That is, on the one hand, parents' life satisfaction, and on the other hand, parents' meaning in life. And the main finding with regard to these two concepts is that life satisfaction actually varies a lot for parents in different circumstances, whereas meaning in life is consistently high for those who do have children.
What is having a kid due to my satisfaction as a human being?
Well, if you look in the literature and if you look in our study, on average, parents' life satisfaction is not better than that of non-parents. Children are a kind of burden. They are a temporal burden. You have to spend time with your children. They are an emotional burden because they are emotionally demanding and so on. And that's one reason why parents say their life satisfaction might be lower than that of non-parents.
Our listeners know this, but you're speaking to the choir here. Gabe and I are parents. This fits everything I know. And yet what I believe is also true in your study is that some parents do better than other parents. Their life satisfaction doesn't drop as much. And I'm curious to know, how do they do that?
Well, first, it's their personal situation. For example, those with a partner do better than single parents, and I think that's something everyone would understand. Those with higher education do better because their financial situation might be better. So this is good in terms of your life satisfaction. But what is also good for your life satisfaction is whether or not you're in a country where there is support for parents. And we see this particular in the Nordic countries. There is much less variation between parents in different life circumstances.
For all of our listeners out there who are parents and don't live in Scandinavia and cannot reasonably be expected to convince their government to change things, is there anything in the literature that shows a personal change in my life that I'm capable of making? I can't go out and get a new partner immediately who's going to help me take care of the kid. I can't change my lifestyle or suddenly make more money. Is there a tip or trick to make my satisfaction slightly better as a parent that I'm capable of doing?
So if we think that the Nordic countries provide support for parents, that might be something that parents in challenging circumstances may try to seek to get support, like getting support with a childcare, getting support in everyday life, getting support in coping with all the challenges and demands of their children. So I think it's seeking support might be the answer of your question.
Let's get to the good news. You mentioned the word meaning before. And were you using two different meters to measure well-being? So on the one hand, you've got satisfaction, and on the other hand, you've got meaning. Does that mean that, how are those two things different, satisfaction and meaning?
So I think the main difference is life satisfaction, or how we consider it to be, is a cognitive evaluation of your situation now, whereas meaning in life means that you see something beyond yourself that gives you this kind of meaning. So where the one hand is more now, the other one is more forward-looking and a broader concept. And that's really the good story of our research, is that kids do give you meaning in life.
When I told my wife what we were going to be talking about today, I asked her, because at that point I had just brought my little girl Heidi to kindergarten on my way back, and I asked her, what would your life be like without Heidi? And she said, I would vanish into air. And it seems that concept of trying to define what a kid does to your sense of meaning is almost impossible to say with words. So I'm asking you as a researcher, how do you define what kids will do to a human being with regard to meaning?
So what we actually did is we were analyzing data from a questionnaire where 40,000 people in Europe were asked a question on whether or not they feel that what they do in their life is valuable and worthwhile. And that's what we consider to capture meaning in life.
That's different than what I thought you were going to say, because I've never, ever in my life had to think about meaning in this, or at least this deeply. I would have thought that this seems to imply a future tense. And if we zoom away from, I'm sorry, or that meaning implies a future tense, that if we zoom away from kids for just a second here, what is meaning? To me, it kind of implies that after I'm gone, something I've done will continue to change this place, hopefully for the better, obviously for the better. Kids do that. Maybe building a library does that, or a bridge. That would give me meaning, but that's not what you're asking here.
Well, we're asking if they think that what they do is valuable and worthwhile. And, that might be some aspect of what you just sketched, this kind of, I'm doing something that reaches beyond myself, beyond my own needs. I'm doing something that is valuable and worthwhile. That could be also, by the way, you may get meaning in your work or meaning in any other aspect of life. But the interesting thing is, what we observe is that for parents, the answers to this question is higher than for non-parents. So even if non-parents may have sources of this value and worthwhile activities, they are not as consistently show up as for the parents.
Do you have any advice for the non-parents out there who are going to remain non-parents? And I don't say this as a critique. There's kind of this tendency to be like, they're not having kids these days. No, a lot of people now, a lot of young people would want to possibly have kids, and they don't think it's reachable because they can't afford it. Everything's becoming more expensive. They won't have a place of their own to raise these kids in, so they can't do it. And now they find out from you that in addition to all of that, their life will probably have less meaning statistically or on average. What can they do concretely to give their life more meaning?
Well, I think that's a challenge, to find something that gives meaning in life. That those who don't have kids, they can find meaning in life, and it seems to be that something that is associated with caring, as children require a lot of care, is a source of meaning. So I wouldn't say recommendation, but an idea would be to look around for things that involve some kind of caring. If it's caring for friends, doing volunteer job, being active in a civic organization. I think meaning, that's the core of the meaning. Try something to find that goes beyond yourself.
I don't think I would usually ask this, Marita, but it's I think it fits. Do you have children? And if not, or if you do, how does that affect how you find meaning or satisfaction in your life?
Well, I do have 4 kids, and it's really a huge number in German families. And I'm always asked, how do you did that, raising 4 kids and being a professor? And it partly reflects what we find here. Children are a challenge. And that's it. In the everyday challenge, there is this caring for every day and every day trying to get the kids to the kindergarten, getting kids to work, support them wherever they need support. So I would fully say for my life, if I would have been asked my life satisfaction when the kids were young, I would have said, oh, yes, I do have a lot of work and I'm really stressed. However, what I also see is this meaning component that once there are these kids, if you have this experience of going beyond yourself, doing something with a greater purpose, then that's the source where children come in. They do give you a sense of purpose that is just there.
Do you ever, I guess like I do, sometimes fantasize or daydream about the Marita Jacob that would exist without children and what her life would have been like? And does it, do you do that? No, you're kind of shaking your head like you don't. No?
I haven't asked that question myself because there is no counterfactual. So that's my life, and there is not the possibility to think how my life would have been if I would be another person, because I'm the person as I am. There would be a huge lack in my life, but I don't know. Perhaps it wouldn't, because that's a counterfactual. I don't know it.
Marita Jacob speaking to us there hypothetically at the end from her office at Cologne University about the version of herself, which she just straight up denied. It's a counterfactual. She can't imagine a Marita Jacob without kids.
See, that's the premise of so much literature out there. The one that comes to mind, the last one, The Midnight Library, that's a book, it was a bestseller, about being able to pull out from a library different versions of your life and to see them, to experience, to feel them. That's why I ask that, because I do that. I can't help but do. I wish I had a telescope to look at the Connor Dillon who didn't have kids, because I think it would help me to realize he's not that much different and didn't do anything special.
You know what I want to know is not whether you're satisfied or what you're... Where are you right now? Where is that, Connor?
Me? Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Oh, where would he be?
Yeah.
Probably just working longer and I don't think I would be doing anything more special. I have this fantasy that he's like, I don't know, super...
That's it. Where is he in your fantasy?
Better at playing music.
But where privately. Physically? Where on the earth are you?
Oh, still, yeah, here. I'm here. I'm probably like, that's what's so interesting. I'm probably just like a little bit of a faster runner. Not much. And that's so stupid to say that matters to me at all. It's just occasionally I do these races. And so I kind of think about it. And I think it'd be helpful to see how these tiny differences are stupid. Who cares? And how I did make the right choice. It's just you're left looking at these branches and wondering where they would have gone.
I guess I would be better at golf.
Yeah, and who cares? I know. And instead we have wonderful little humans running around.
For the parents out there, what would you be? That's what I want to know. Yeah. What is that version of yourself? Let us know about it. And for the non-parents out there, who are you? Where are you? Tell us that version. That'll be fine for me.
SUDW.com.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.